This is Teddy Roosevelt, just back from charging up San Juan Hill. Damn it, Professor Buzzkill was already at the top, collecting historical evidence, busting myths, and taking names. I have to admit that he's a worthy competitor, and a damn fine rough rider. Join me in listening to this episode. It's sure to be bully.
Sadly, tragically, infuriatingly, it seems that every time there's a mass shooting in the United States, the same sorts of arguments come up from the same opposing sides. Gun control advocates say that there's only one solution: more gun control. Gun rights advocates argue that gun ownership and the right to carry are inviolable and almost sacred. Near the sidelines of this debate in the United States, you sometimes hear a little bit about the history of the most powerful gun rights organization in the United States. Indeed, one of the most powerful political organizations of any kind, the National Rifle Association. But you never hear very much about the NRA's history. The story that's sometimes told is that the NRA used to be a sportsman's organization that concentrated on marksmanship and hunters' rights, and that for some reason it has taken a very strict view of the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment and has gone to extremes in its defense of gun ownership in the last several decades. And you'll hear that longtime members of the NRA, such as former President George H.W. Bush, resigned from that organization because of this change, and did so very publicly in order to distance themselves from what has become, in essence, the new NRA. I'm not going to talk about the history of the famous Second Amendment to the United States Constitution, nor even talk about the changing interpretations of that amendment. I'll leave that to a later show if you want one on that topic. Since this episode is bound to get a lot of attention, positive and negative, I better make sure that everyone has all our contact information right up front. Comments on this episode can, of course, be placed on Twitter at BuzzkillProf and Instagram at Professor Buzzkill and Facebook at, which is Professor Buzzkill. But you can also send hate mail or love mail or email of any kind to info@professorbuzzkill.com or professor@professorbuzzkill.com. The origins of the National Rifle Association can be traced to the American Civil War. Several prominent American sportsmen suggested that the United States, and specifically the gathering Union Army forces, needed to have an organization like the British National Rifle Association, founded in 1859. The British NRA, which by the way is now called the National Rifle Association of the United Kingdom, was created as a sportsman's organization and created, quote, for the promotion of marksmanship in the interests of defense of the realm. The American version of the British NRA didn't really get going till after the war. A number of things seem to indicate that Union Army troops had been undertrained as marksmen. General Ambrose Burnside publicly complained, for instance, that only 10% of Union infantrymen could, quote, hit the broadside of a barn, end quote. Additionally, some wartime statistics gathered by Union Army officials seem to indicate that Union soldiers fired nearly 1,000 shots for every Confederate soldier they injured or killed. And that led Burnside and these others to conclude that the boys in blue were bad shots and needed to be better trained for the next war. So the National Rifle Association was formed in New York in 1871. And not surprisingly, it was led mainly by former Union generals and high-ranking officers. It encouraged the formation of state and local shooting clubs and helped form rifle teams to compete against other nations in international shooting competitions. The NRA continued as a national umbrella organization for local and state rifle clubs across the U.S. for the rest of the 19th century and the early decades of the 20th century. The NRA's work was all very respectable and uncontroversial. So much so that former Union general and president Ulysses S. Grant was an early NRA president, as was another former Union general and Civil War hero, Philip Sheridan. The NRA concentrated almost completely on shooting competitions and promoting the idea that the country needed well-trained civilian marksmen. And it worked in parallel with government plans such as the Civilian Marksmanship Program created by Congress in 1903. Now, the NRA moved its headquarters to Washington, D.C. in 1907. And keep that in mind. We're going to get back to it later. It's very, very important. And in the 19-teens and 1920s, it worked, again, with the government, the War Department, even to the point that the War Department provided ammunition and other marksmanship training materials to rifle clubs across the country, including those run by the NRA. Little changed during the 1930s, except that the federal government reacted to the increase in violent crime and to the even greater increase in the perception of rising crime and the sensationalizing of gangsters in fiction by passing the first national gun control law, the National Firearms Act of 1934. This was basically a licensing act requiring gun manufacturers and sellers to keep careful and exact records of guns produced and to whom they were sold. It also made it illegal to sell or transfer guns to convicted felons and other, quote, prohibited persons, unquote. For the most part, the NRA supported the passage of the National Firearms Act of 1934. During the congressional hearings held when the bill was being considered, NRA President Carl Frederick said, quote, "I have never believed in the general practice of carrying weapons. I seldom carry one. I do not believe in the general promiscuous toting of guns. I think it should be sharply restricted and only under license," end quote. World War II and its immediate aftermath pushed more or less everything off the national agenda during the 1940s, and even during the height of McCarthyite paranoia about communist cells infiltrating the government and other major institutions in the 1950s, the NRA remained what it had been for almost 100 years, a sportsman's organization that only worried about gun control legislation if it meant restricting the rights of hunters and outdoorsmen. The 1960s were different, however. Even the tense Cold War of the 1950s hadn't extinguished all romantic notions about the inevitability of a bright American future. But the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963 and the growing divisions over the Vietnam War during the mid-60s helped suffocate what few romantic notions remained. Popular political activism broadened. More and more Americans of different backgrounds and with different agendas pushed for changes, sometimes even harder than the civil rights movement had been doing so for the previous 15 years. Perhaps the most important organization in this part of the story about the NRA and gun control wasn't actually the NRA. It was the Black Panther Party. Their original name, as many of you know, was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Founded in Oakland, California by Bobby Seale and Huey Newton in late 1966, the Black Panthers were initially motivated by what they saw as police brutality and overreaction against suspected lawbreakers who were African American. The Black Panthers started patrolling Oakland streets and observing policemen during traffic stops, during arrests of crime suspects, and any other policing done in largely African American neighborhoods. Much as modern-day people monitor and film some police action with their cell phones in order to record potential abuse of police power, the Black Panthers saw themselves as fulfilling an essential public duty. Now, this being 1966, obviously the Black Panthers didn't have cell phones. They did, however, have shotguns, and they carried them with them, loaded, during their patrols. And again, this being 1966, it was perfectly legal for the Panthers or any other citizens to carry weapons openly in California. Now, as you might imagine, this frightened the Oakland police tremendously, and there were several tense standoffs, although there were no shootouts or anything like that during the Panthers' patrols. Still, for the rest of 1966 and most of 1967, California politicians, frankly, freaked out about armed Black Panthers in California cities. California State Assembly and the California Governor, Ronald Reagan, put forward firearms control legislation almost immediately. And on May 2nd, 1967, the Panthers attended one of the assembly's committee meetings that was considering one of these pieces of legislation. And they did so armed. That's right, you heard me. They did so armed. Panic ensued in the chamber. Some legislators dove under their desks, and voices, to say the least, were raised. It was nothing more than that, however. The Panthers did not discharge their weapons, nor point them at anyone, or threaten any of the assembly members. The incident escalated essentially into a very heated argument, but no one was hurt. The police arrested six of the Panthers, but charged them with the only thing they could charge them with, quote, disrupting a legislative session, which was a misdemeanor. Again, carrying the shotguns was not illegal. Still, California passed the 1967 Mulford Act, which made it illegal to carry a loaded firearm in public. Now, this was a significant gun control act. But don't get me wrong, no serious and well-read scholar of this period and this topic now questions the fact that it was the sight of young, seemingly angry and armed black men that terrified mostly white California politicians, who then enacted gun control measures like this very, very quickly. Okay, Professor, I hear you saying, why are you going on about the Black Panthers in a show that's supposed to be about the NRA? The reason is that the swift government reaction to the Panthers' actions, as well as to the crime, violence, murders, and assassinations of 1968, started to worry a small minority, I don't want to stress, minority of the NRA. These were those who took the absolutist view of the meaning of the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment about the right to keep and bear arms. This small group believed that the Second Amendment guaranteed Americans the right to own as many guns as they wanted, to have as much ammunition as they wanted, and to carry those guns and that ammunition with them in public, unhindered by government legislation or police interference. Now, after the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy in mid-1968, President Lyndon Johnson promoted a national gun control bill. The bill was opposed by some members of the NRA, as well as the Wildlife Management Institute, the Sport Fishing Institute, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, and the Sporting Arms and Ammunition Manufacturers Institute. By pressuring sympathetic members of Congress, they were able to water the bill down. These lobbyists were afraid that this 1968 bill would be the start of a slippery slope towards eventual gun confiscation. Ultimately, however, they accepted what was left in the bill, mainly because, as NRA Executive Vice President Franklin Orth would write in American Rifleman, that's the NRA's magazine, quote, the measure as a whole appears to be one that the sportsmen of America can live with. Congress passed the bill and LBJ signed it into law on October 11th, 1968. It supplemented the 1934 Firearms Act, which remember required licensing, and it strengthened it by regulating interstate trade in guns, right? What LBJ would call murder by mail order. Prior to the 1968 Act, moving and selling guns between states was one of the ways that criminals and criminal organizations could skirt the restrictions of gun registration, which was limited to the registration efforts of each state. Still, LBJ was depressed that the Act wasn't stronger. And here's something of what he said at the signing ceremony for the Act.
The Congress adopted most of our recommendations. But this bill, as big as this bill is, still falls short because we just could not get the Congress to carry out the requests we made of them. I ask for the national registration of all guns and the licenses of those who carry those guns. For the fact of life is, that there are over 160 million guns in this country. More firearms than families. And if guns are to be kept out of the hands of the criminal, and out of the hands of the insane, and out of the hands of the irresponsible, then we just must have licensing. If the criminal with a gun is to be tracked down quickly, then we must have registration in this country. The voices that blocked these safeguards were not the voices of an aroused nation. They were the voices of a powerful lobby, a gun lobby, that has prevailed for the moment in an election year.
Now, among other things, you heard LBJ say that there were more firearms than families. And we'll revisit that observation near the end of this show. For the rest of the 1960s and the first half of the 1970s, the strict Second Amendment interpretation minority of the NRA became more and more worried, some would say paranoid, because in the wake of 1968, they thought that the government would push through stronger gun control legislation, and they really worried that the moderate majority of the NRA membership, and more importantly, perhaps the moderate NRA leadership, would do nothing, or almost nothing, to stop stricter gun control laws from being enacted. Further, the relatively moderate NRA leadership had decided that they were going to leave Washington, D.C., going to move to Colorado, and we're going to concentrate on the outdoorsman and sportsman aspect of the organization. They had decided to shift their focus to further promoting hunting and outdoor life and sort of get out of the lobbying business. And again, these things, not lobbying the federal government to stop gun control, had been the NRA's main purpose since its founding. And so the executive board expected no trouble when they planned to announce these changes to the assembled membership during the NRA's annual meeting, which was to be held in Cincinnati in the key year of 1977. 1968 and 1977, two absolutely essential years in this story. That NRA leadership didn't realize how strong the fundamentalist Second Amendment interpretation minority of their own organization had become. Or at least, they didn't realize how well organized and determined they were to purify the NRA, that it was to stop the move to Colorado, to turn the organization's new Institute for Legislative Action into a fearsome and powerful lobbying organization. Led by Neil Knox, this committed group of NRA purists had been working together since the mid-70s to fix the NRA the way they thought it should be fixed. And they came to the 1977 Cincinnati meeting prepared to make it all happen. What's now known as the Cincinnati Revolution, or the Revolt in Cincinnati, took place on May 21st, and dragged into the early hours of May 22nd. Using the NRA's own bylaws and Robert's Rules of Order, that famous book that explains how to run meetings in a parliamentary fashion, the Knox group managed to hijack the meeting's agenda. Now, this revolution, this 1977 Cincinnati thing deserves, or at least almost deserves, a show of its own. But in sum, the Knox purists managed to kill the association's planned move to Colorado, managed to have the whole NRA executive, that's those moderate people that I talked about, voted out of office, and they themselves, the Knox group, the purists, put in their place. And they charged the NRA's Institute for Legislative Action with all the power and ultimately all the resources it would need to put pressure on the government to support and fund like-minded politicians' campaigns and to fight gun control advocates in elections and in the halls of Congress. That's when the NRA started to become extreme, and that's how the NRA started to become extreme. Now, what about after Cincinnati? Although the NRA has had plenty of other internal struggles from the 1980s till today, including its current financial crisis, overall, it has gone from strength to strength since that pivotal moment in Cincinnati. The combination of two things, the organizational takeover by the Knox radicals and keeping the NRA in Washington, D.C., in essence, keeping it at the center of political power and the political movers and shakers, created the modern NRA. Since 1977, with the exception of the passage of the assault weapons ban in 1994, the NRA has successfully ensured that gun control legislation has never gotten very far. Even that assault weapons ban only lasted for 10 years. It expired in 2004 without Congress renewing it. And since then, of course, the numbers of mass shootings and gun deaths have gone up dramatically. In his statement at the signing of the 1968 Gun Control Act, President Johnson referred to the fact that there were more than 160 million guns in the United States, more firearms than families, as LBJ said. Just over 50 years later, there are not more firearms than families. There are more firearms than people, more guns than individuals. There are roughly 326,474,000 people in the United States today, and there are 393,347,000 guns. There are 120 guns for every 100 people in our country. And the mass shootings and death by gunfire have increased along with this arms race we seem to be having between ourselves. You may have noticed at the beginning of the show that I didn't specify which mass shootings I was referring to, nor did I give a date. The cynical show business devil on my shoulder type urged me to do this because that way the show could be repeated and not sound dated, that is, dated to a particular shooting or series of shootings. And that's a sickening truth. I could have recorded this show during the first year of this podcast, 2015, and I could have replayed it every 6 months since. The essence of the story that I've given you wouldn't have changed, and each repeat, each replay, each encore presentation would have proved relevant to the month and the year it was played. It would never have to be mothballed or archived. In terms of getting attention and new listeners, it would be evergreen. The humane, the normal, and the sane angel on my other shoulder urges me to stress the evergreen nature of this topic for that very reason. Because maybe seeing how horribly evergreen it is can help awaken more people to this horrific and shameful trend. Again and again and again, these killings do not stop. The frequency increases now, the body count increases. And genuine extremists, like the organization that the NRA has become, as well as their political lapdogs, are doing everything they can to keep weapons of war on the street and in the marketplace. I don't want to trivialize this problem by referring again to the hardiness and the continued usefulness of this topic in getting ratings and numbers for this podcast. I can only hope that this episode and his blog post will give a little extra impetus to the gun control movement. Very rarely do I promote other organizations on this show, but please, please, please take time to join and to contribute to groups such as Every Town for Gun Safety, the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, and the tragically but necessarily named Moms Demand Action. Links for these groups are in the blog post for this episode. Let's work to cure this national madness. If we do, we can make podcast episodes, news stories, and editorial essays about gun control truly a part of our past. We want these stories to become archival. and of interest only to historians and other scholars in the future who try to understand why the people of the United States allowed these gun murders to continue. Now, before I go, I want to return briefly to June 6, 1968. Here is part of the statement that President Johnson gave when he proposed his gun control bill, the one that would become the Gun Control Act of 1968, on the day after the shooting of Robert Kennedy.
Today, the nation cries out to the conscience of the Congress. Criminal violence from the muzzle of a gun has once again brought heartbreak to America. Surely, this must be clear beyond question. The hour has come for the Congress to enact a strong and effective gun control law governing the full range of lethal weapons. I have sought and I have fought for such a law through all the days of my presidency. On many occasions before, I have spoken of the terrible toll inflicted on our people by firearms. 750,000 Americans dead since the turn of the century. This is far more than have died at the hands of all of our enemies in all of the wars that we have fought. Sorrow and suffering that just cannot be counted, and fear that can never be measured. When I last appealed to the Congress on this subject again, and that was only a month ago, I asked this question: what in the name of conscience will it take to pass a truly effective gun control law in the Congress? And now, in this new hour of tragedy, that question should at last be answered. So let us now spell out our grief in constructive action.
What in the name of conscience, indeed? That statement is over 50 years old, and things have only gotten worse. Nothing would make me happier than knowing that this podcast episode will sound strange and distantly historical to future generations. If it does, that will mean that somehow we have finally taken up President Johnson's plea. We will have spelled out our grief in constructive action. Talk to you next week.